Lombardi, Judge Clary, Judge Peterson, the Honorable James B. Foy presiding.
Good morning, and please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have six matters on our calendar today on October the 3rd of 2019, four matters for oral argument this morning. Council, I'm sure you're familiar with our rules. You'll each have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And I'd ask you, as you begin your arguments, please identify yourselves for the record. So with that, we'll call the first case. It's A19-0379, Gensmer versus the Department of Labor and Industry. Counsel for appellant, you may proceed when you're ready. Feel free to adjust the podium to your comfort if you need to.
Your Honors, good morning. May it please the court, my name is John Steffenhagen. My colleague Ryan Tice and I are appearing on behalf of the estate of Thompson Deckey. We are seeking reversal of the district court's grant of summary judgment for two principal reasons. One, the district court erred with respect to the application of each of the three prongs of the McDonnell-Douglas test. Two, the district court erred granting summary judgment regarding Sendecki's claim of a failure to accommodate his known disability of alcoholism. And I will address both of those points in turn. Point number one, the prima facie case is well known to this court, as is the McDonnell-Douglas construct. So I will address each of the three prongs rather than addressing the law that has been in place since the United States Supreme Court enunciated the test. First, the prima facie case. In Dans v. Jones, courts of this state have held that the burden of establishing a prima facie case is not difficult. In Dans v. Jones, the court held that the plaintiff need merely show the basics of discrimination. Now, in this case, the district court properly held that Sendecki had established a prima facie case under the Americans with Disabilities Act. The court erred, however, when it held that Sendecki did not establish a prima facie case under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And specifically, the court's holding in that regard is that Sendecki was required to prove that he was replaced by a non-member of the protected class. In other words, the district court held that there was no prima facie case established because Sendecki did not prove that he was replaced by a non-alcoholic individual.
Well, hasn't our Supreme Court, Mr. Steffenhagen, in the Hoover case said that that is one of the required elements, that you were replaced by a non-member of the protected class?
It's interesting that in examination of the cases, each of the three cases cited by the district court for that exact proposition did not rule upon that specific issue. In other words, Your Honor, what the court did is enunciate the test, but the salient holding of each of those three cases did not depend upon that element. Now, to answer the question directly, yes, there is case law for that proposition, but none of the cases that are cited by the district court actually use that as a basis.
Well, is there a case that says otherwise, that you don't need to do it?
Absolutely, there is. Puller versus Independent School District, cited in our brief, that was a sex discrimination case for failure to hire. In that case, the court specifically held that it was unnecessary for the plaintiff to prove that the employer instead hired a man. There is abundant case law in federal court under the ADA saying that it is not a requirement. And of course, in Minnesota, given the dovetailing between the two statutes, Minnesota courts have long give accord to federal law in that respect. So there is no dichotomy between Minnesota and federal law with respect to the prima facie case. Point two, if a prima facie case is established, the burden shifts to the employer to enunciate a legitimate, non-discriminatory reason for the employee's termination. The district court erred because it weighed countervailing evidence in that regard. Sandecki's evidence was clear, it was undisputed, it was consistent. In this case, HR Specialist Arvin for DOI testified that she could not identify how the existing medical documentation was insufficient. She testified that she could not identify any support for the proposition that DOI had not received adequate information, medical information. She testified that she did not know what information would be sufficient. Very probatively, she testified that she could not substantiate any portion of her critical November 18, 2014 letter. Now, DOI's response to that is brief. It's limited to one paragraph of their responsive brief. The district court's holding regarding those key factors is a primary reason why this grant of summary judgment should be reversed, because the district court at pages 18 to 19 of its order held that the testimony of DOI specialist Arvin and the testimony of Tom Sandecki's own supervisor at DOI, Mr. Best, should be, in the court's words, negated by documentary evidence. That's the term that the district court used. One form of evidence, in the court's mind, was negated by documentary evidence. Now, as a threshold proposition, that's a dubious conclusion in the first place, to argue that the testimony of the author of a document is less important than the document itself. But more to the point, for the purpose today, before this court, that is a classic example of a fact issue. That is an example of a district court preferring one form of evidence over another. So, DOI.
How does that play out here? Isn't one of them is a letter saying something specific? The other is testimony saying, I don't know. So where is the basis for reaching a fact determination with evidence that says, I don't know? What fact could you determine with that testimony?
I think the elemental part of that question is when I present a document to a witness, as I did with the November 18 letter, and I asked Ms. Arvin to explain the letter, and I point to key provisions about why was this sentence true or why was medical documentation lacking, and she says, I don't know. That, to me, is a figurative softball when I give a witness a document and ask her to explain it, and she literally cannot. There is not one provision of the November 18, 2014 letter that Ms. Arvin could substantiate. So your Honor's question is on point, as were my questions during the deposition. This is not a case of creative lawyering, and this is not a case of selective citation to deposition testimony on the record. It is instead a case where the witness's own document was presented to her and she was unable to substantiate anything that it said. That's probative. That belonged to a jury. It was not the district court's function to say that that sort of evidence from a witness itself is negated by a letter that she could not substantiate.
Well, she didn't dispute writing it, did she?
She did not.
Right. So the letter was written at a time in the proceedings when that was the information that DLI was requesting from your client. I mean, how do we just disregard the validity of that letter in terms of what was required to be produced or what DLI requested that your client produce to support his leave?
I don't think anything should be disregarded, including Ms. Arvin's letter. It is proof. Absolutely it's proof. But the point today is that there's countervailing proof. There's countervailing proof from the testimony of the witness who drafted the letter itself. So we're not arguing that one should be accepted rather than another. What we're arguing today and what the law is that that's a fact issue. It is not a district court's function to say that one form of evidence...
What is the fact to be determined here?
The fact to be determined, number one, is whether they established a legitimate, non-discriminatory reason for firing Thompson Deckey when he was alcoholic.
Okay, and the claim is that he didn't produce medical records necessary to get the leave that he needed or wanted.
That is the claim. And the countervailing evidence, which then goes to the third prong.
So what role does this letter and the testimony, what fact is that supposed to determine with respect to that issue?
That was the key letter. That November 18 letter was the one that gave him 4 days, 4 calendar days, to produce responsive information or he was fired.
Okay, so if that letter is credible, admissible evidence,
yes,
you could conclude that he was told that he needed to produce medical evidence of some sort.
If it is found credible by a jury, and a jury believes it, absolutely, yes.
So what basis would the testimony be to, would it be just to reject the letter altogether?
I'm not saying it should be rejected altogether. What I'm saying is...
What process is the jury supposed to go through in terms of reaching some fact determination here?
The court, the district court in this court, should view all the sorts of evidence that was available in this case, including the testimony of the individual who drafted the letter. It should include as well.
Right, but I'm trying to understand what fact it is that you're saying is in dispute based on these two pieces of evidence.
That Thompson Deckey was fired because he was alcoholic. That's the ultimate fact in dispute in this case.
Counsel, just to go back, because I'm a little bit confused too. He knew that he was only authorized for outpatient treatment, correct? Not continuous or full-time or anything past that at that point.
I would say it's debatable because Mr. Best himself said that he recognized and discussed with Tom Sendecki that Tom needed inpatient treatment. But otherwise, based on the letter, I would agree with Your Honor. Yes.
Okay, so now it's gone beyond that. He receives a letter that suggests that he needs to provide further documentation if he's going to change the original terms of the leave. And we can argue about the time he was given to do it, but the fact is that I don't see the fact issue either. I mean, in other words, he's gone beyond the original agreement. He's told to provide documentation. He doesn't do that. Now, you started to say it also impacts the third element. Are you suggesting there's pretext here?
I'm absolutely suggesting there is pretext, Your Honor, yes.
And in what way?
There's pretext because Your Honor correctly noted that we can question the timing. We absolutely can question the timing, but the law establishes under the FMLA that DLI was required to give him 15 days to produce medical documentation and did not. That's 29 CFR 313. Pretext is shown as well by evidence that they have used inconsistent positions.
There's no FMLA claim before us, though.
There is not. Not currently. But the law regarding, at the time, what they were required to give Tom Sendecki required 15 days. So it is probative to the ADA claim.
What does the 15 days in the FMLA have to do with a MHRA claim?
It's the federal law is accepted by Minnesota courts in interpretive of the MHRA claim. In this case, federal law said that Tom Sendecki had 15 days that they did not provide. But that is not the only evidence of pretext in this case. The evidence of pretext may be found by inconsistencies in the employer's rationale. In this case, under Minnesota Statute 181.933, DLI was required to state in writing the truthful reasons for the termination of Tom Sendecki's employment. That reason was that Tom Sendecki left work on November 25th, 2014, and did not return. The fact of the matter is he was told to leave that day, and he was fired by the time he got home. That's an inconsistent reason. There are 8 separate reasons that are inconsistent that we've identified in our brief that DLI has made in this case. 2, pretext can be shown by a deviation from the employer's own policy. In this case, that is present as well. DLI, its ADA coordinator, is Gail Creek. She was never presented with Tom Sendecki's request for a leave. That's a deviation from their own policy. An untrue statement is evidence of pretext. pages 40 to 40.
What request was she not presented with?
She was not presented with the fact that Tom Sendecky had requested inpatient leave. She was not presented with any of the facts upon which Ms. Arvin fired Mr. Sendecky, excuse me. So she was not presented with the crux of what was at issue in this case.
He never presented any kind of a document saying, I want the broader leave, did he?
A document? No.
Is there some form that needs to be filled out to do that? Is it just an oral process?
According to Mr. Best, it was an oral process. When he got leave and talked to Mr. Best did not say, you need to submit more documentation. He did not say you need to go back to your doctor. He did not say anything about that. So there's pretext as well in this case. And I'll respect the time that my question's up, and obviously address Your Honor's questions on rebuttal.
You'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal, Mr. Steffenhagen. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. Juliana Passy on behalf of the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. The key undisputed facts in this case is that Mr. Sendecky provided the department with his doctor's certification that specifically provided that he did not need full-day continuous leave. And despite DLI's repeated statements that it required such documentation for his continuous absences from work, he failed to provide any supporting medical documentation. Another key undisputed fact is that during his absence from work, Mr. Sendecky did not receive any treatment. He rejected available treatment providers for a number of personal reasons, and he continued to abuse alcohol.
So why are those facts relevant here, or why do they matter?
Those facts are relevant as to, certainly as to the failure to accommodate claim, the fact that Mr. Sendecky was not, in fact, receiving treatment, the fact that he rejected treatment providers is certainly relevant to the reasonableness of the accommodation, the alleged accommodation of a period of time with which to seek medical treatment, a period of time to reach out to potential medical providers in this case.
Why wasn't it reasonable for him to rely on his conversation with his direct supervisor, Mr. Best, when they discussed the need that he needed more intensive treatment, and there was a discussion about him taking the time that he needed for that?
2 points on that, Your Honor. First, Mr. Best, Mr. Sendecky had FMLA treatments prior in the past. He had, on both occasions, worked with HR on that request and had not worked directly with his supervisor. And the second point, Your Honor, is that the testimony isn't that Mr. Best told Mr. Sendecky that he could have as much leave as he needed. What we have in this is a disputed fact as to what precisely happened during that conversation. Taking things in the most light favorable to the non-moving party for the purposes of summary judgment, Mr. Sendecky testified that Mr. Best told him that he could, quote, take 30 days if he needed to see what, take 30 days, request 30 days. Mr. Best's actions directly after that, to the extent Mr. Sendecky believed that take 30 days meant he could go off on leave, he was authorized under the FMLA. That was directly rebutted by Mr. Best's subsequent conduct in calling Mr. Sendecky when he was absent from work. The very next day, Mr. Best called him at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and says, where are you? What's going on? And then again on Tuesday, November 18th, he called him again when Mr. Sendecky had not called in and says, where are you? And it's undisputed that Mr. Sendecky, to the extent he took his conversation with Mr. Best to authorize such leave, he was explicitly informed by the department on November 18th, by the November 18th letter, that he, in fact, was not authorized and he needed to provide further medical documentation. And it told him what medical documentation it needed, medical documentation explaining why he needed to be absent from work, the likely duration of his absence, things that the department needed in order to determine whether or not he was entitled to FMLA leave or any other kind of medical leave. Your Honor, I'd like to briefly just address the prima facie case under the MHRA. As Your Honors have pointed out, Minnesota case law does provide for that fourth prong. The Puller case, which is a Court of Appeals case, not a Supreme Court case, is a motion to dismiss case discussing the pleading standard rather than a summary judgment case. Obviously, we're on summary judgment at this point.
So why does that matter with respect to whether that fourth element is an element of the cause of action?
Well, it matters in that the Hoover case is actually subsequent to it, Your Honor. Moreover, it was talking about notice pleading and what is required to plead. In that case, the district court got rid of a case on a motion to dismiss solely based on the fact that they hadn't pleaded that a man was hired instead of a woman. I believe that's also the failure to hire case. The requirements of a prima facie case are slightly different in those cases as well. So I believe that the Hoover case is directly on point. As to appellant's arguments about Ms. Arvin's testimony, appellant made the choice during the deposition not to refresh Ms. Arvin's recollection by showing her, for example, the medical documentation that Mr. Sendecki had provided to the departments. Importantly, she testifies in her deposition that she does not remember what documentation he provided. Her subsequent, when her recollection was refreshed, she was able to, obviously, in her affidavit, was able to describe what was missing from his documentation, namely the fact that his medical documentation explicitly provided that he did not need continuous leave and that and didn't provide any recommendation of inpatient treatment. As to the pretext arguments, Your Honors, as to the FMLA claims are, as Your Honors have observed, they're no longer in front of this court. The days that were required were vigorously disputed by the parties at the district court. But regardless of whatever the requirements are, the ADA and the MHRA are the only claims remaining before the court at this time. And appellant has cited no case law in their brief showing that any particular there's any particular time limitations.
Well, that might be true, counsel, but 4 business days isn't a lot of time. Would you agree?
I would dispute that it's 4 business days, Your Honor. So it was November 18th is the date of the letter. There's also documentation in the record that Ms. Arvin called Mr. Sendecki on November 18th and told him she needed additional medical documentation. So the 18th, 19th, 20th, 21st, and then the 24th and 25th would be actually 6 business days in all 1 calendar week to provide such medical documentation.
And so what is the basis for the appellant to suggest 4 business days? Because they do.
They do. I'm not sure, Your Honor. I think that's a question for appellant.
Thought maybe you knew. Is this? I didn't check the calendar, but this is right around Thanksgiving, isn't it?
It's right before Thanksgiving, Your Honor.
Okay. And sometimes doctors are hard to get a hold of during those kind of weeks. True?
It could be possible, Your Honor. There's certainly testimony in the record that Ms. Arvin suggested to, on that last day, November 25th is the date of the due date for the documentation. You need to provide us by this date or we will consider you to have voluntarily resigned. Ms. Arvin's testimony is that she told Mr. Sendecki he needs to, even if his doctor's out of the office, he can go to the doctor's office, see if there's someone there who can explain provide him with some documentation or provide him with any kind of a statement saying that the doctor is, in fact, out of the office. There's no medical documentation of Mr. Sendecki doing such. We know that he went to the doctor after the end of the business day that day.
Are you aware of any case law that would interpret what a reasonable time period is under ADA?
I am not, Your Honor. So the timing provision really comes under the FMLA, not under the ADA. Under the ADA, the employer is only required to accommodate if the employee has provided sufficient medical documentation if the need for accommodation is not obvious. Here, the department asked for the medical documentation. Mr. Sendecki failed to provide medical documentation and therefore was not required to accommodate him by giving him an extended period of leave, especially an extended period of leave when he was not actually in treatment.
So would you suggest that 24 hours would have been enough? It sounds like you would.
I don't believe there's any case law directly on point. I think that would be And the typical scenario, Your Honor, would be if an employee knows that he's going to be going out on some kind of leave, he has a heart surgery coming up, or he has cancer, or something like that, I'm going to be needing leave, and he requests leave and says, I'm going to need this going forward in the future. In this case, he decides Mr. Sendecki is, the employee is absent from work for a period of time. The department is wondering where he is, wondering what he's doing, which I think really informs the analysis of what is the employer required to tolerate before taking some kind of adverse action. And here, Mr. Sendecki was absent for a period of time. The case law is clear that absences that are caused by a disability, misconduct that's caused by alcoholism or drug addiction, for example, the employer can take adverse action because of that. That doesn't save you. If you drive drunk because you're an alcoholic, for example, if you're absent from work because you're drinking, that is not something that the employer is barred from holding against you in your performance. As to the alleged inconsistencies in the DLI's proffered reasons, Your Honors, examination of the record clearly demonstrates that the department has repeatedly and consistently stated that his leave or his employment ended because he was absent from work for 8 consecutive work days and didn't provide any medical documentation demonstrating his need to be absent. Plaintiff's argument in this regard really takes out of context various statements of the department. Proffers things as reasons for any Mr. Sendecki's employment that were never actually proffered by the department as reasons, and therefore that such an argument is not persuasive. And indeed, even if the department had used slightly different words throughout, you know, merely elaboration of explanation is not evidence of pretext, and discrepancies must be substantial in order to be probative of pretext. And what we have here is certainly not any substantial discrepancies. It's repeatedly saying, Mr. Sendecki, you needed to provide medical documentation and did not and was absent from work. As to deviation from policy, this is really an area of overlap between the FMLA and the ADA. The testimony is clear that Ms. Arvin, as an HR consultant, was the HR consultants at the department are the people who handle FMLA requests. Mr. Sendecki, his testimony is that he presented his request as an FMLA request, and therefore Ms. Arvin was the one to handle such a request.
So what request are you talking about now? The initial one that led to the part-time off, or is there some other request? And when is a request made?
So Mr. Sendecki's testimony, Your Honor, is that on November 13th, when he talks to Bess that second time before he stops being at the department, he talked about, you know, I might need some kind of leave. I think I talked about FMLA with Steve, is what he said.
Does that constitute a request?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think it would be... Certainly, they were certainly exploring their options. The testimony isn't clear as to whether he said, I want FMLA leave for this particular time.
Is there some clear definition of request as to when a request is actually made? I mean, if I'm just saying, I think I might need this or I do need it, is saying I do need it, is that a request?
Under the ADA, it could be, Your Honor. Under the ADA, it's when the employer becomes on notice that the employee might need.
So it doesn't require any formal process of signing your name on a form or anything like that?
Well, it depends on if we're talking ADA or FMLA, Your Honor. Certainly FMLA requests...
We're not talking FMLA here, are we?
We are no longer talking FMLA. This case kind of overlaps in that there were FMLA claims, and the FMLA is really... Mr. Sendecki was framing his leave as I'm entitled to FMLA leave. It is correct that Your Honor is correct in that is no longer before the court.
So then under the ADA, what needed to be done to complete a request or make a request? At what point does a request occur?
A requ- A request occurs when an employee makes clear to a to an employer that he is in fact requesting a leave and will need to be gone for a specific for whatever duration it is. And we don't have that here, Your Honor. He says, I think I might need to go see inpatient treatment.
Oh, so you're saying that a request has to be a request for some specific response or specific terms?
I believe, yes, Your Honor, in that it needs to be clear as to what you're requesting. Are you requesting, if I go into my employer and I say, I need leave, and then I walk out. The employer is entitled to ask those additional questions before we get to the...
So until the employer knows just what the employee is talking about, there hasn't been a request.
There may have been a request, but there's, I think in the ADA, then we get into the, we need to go into the back and forth of the discussion of the reasonable accommodation process and the interactive process of what is the employee requesting, what do they need, and here's where the additional questions come in. And this is where the department got into those additional questions when following up with Mr. Sendecki after he was absent from work. They say, where are you? Why are you absent? They're inquiring as to where he is. They're not expecting he's going to be gone, and then they ultimately tell him we need additional medical documentation. I see I'm out of time, Your Honor. Thank you.
Mr. Stephen Hagen, you have 5 minutes.
The two primary points I'd like to address on rebuttal absolutely interact with each other, and they overlap with each other. The first is Your Honor's question about why such short a period of time for an individual who is undisputedly alcoholic and disabled, whether it's 4 days or whether it's 6 days, the salient point remains the same. Tom Sendecki had banked 222 hours of paid vacation time. He had multiples of that in sick time. They gave him, whether it's 4 or 6, let's assume it's 6 calendar or business days. That is not enough with a Thanksgiving holiday weekend coming up to get those records together.
I thought that he was told that if he said his doctor was out of town.
Correct.
I thought he was told that get documentation that your doctor's out of town and we'll give you more time.
Tom Sendecki disputes that. Tom Sendecki's testimony is clear in the record that he was told, go sit in your doctor's office, and if you don't get the documentation, you're fired. Tom Sendecki's testimony was nothing about that there was some contingency about get a note that your doctor's...
Did he testify that that didn't happen?
I believe he did, yes, Your Honor. He was absolutely clear in his recollection that by the time he returned home that day, he was fired. There was a courier waiting for him with a termination letter that day. So whether it's 4 or whether it's 6, the fact of the matter is that is a fact issue. And that is a fact issue as to both the second and third prong.
What's the fact issue there?
The fact issue would be, number one, is proof of pretext. All right? It's proof that they didn't really intend or give Tom Sendecki time to get medical documentation. They fired him because he was an alcoholic. It absolute evidence of pretext that belonged to a jury. A jury is entitled to hear an instruction from an employer to an alcoholic individual to go sit in your doctor's office as though he is a recalcitrant schoolboy instead of a grown man. That's pretext. Now, keep in mind as well, the truncated period is evidence of pretext as well, and it's evidence under the second prong as well. On November 13, 2014, Tom Sendecki and Steve Best have a conversation in which both of them say, you need inpatient treatment. November 13, that happened. Tom Sendecki dutifully calls in every day. We have call logs that establish it. With no intervening change in facts, November 18 comes, and Arvin gives him the letter. On November 25th, he's done. He's fired. His 222 hours of vacation day cannot be used. His multiples of that of sick days cannot be used. That's evidence of pretext. It's evidence of an employer not following the law. That is the essence of the McDonnell-Douglas test. If an employer did not follow the law, that's evidence.
What is the pretextual reason that you're talking about then? What's the pretext?
There's multiple evidence of pretext. The pretext.
No, I want to know what is the pretext. I don't want to know what the evidence. I mean, what pretext are you claiming occurred here?
They fired Tom Sendecki because he's alcoholic. They fired Tom Sendecki because alcoholism requires extended treatment that they didn't want to accommodate.
So you're saying that the request for medical documentation was pretext?
In the manner in which it was given, absolutely 100%, yes, it was pretext. Now, Your Honor asked a good question about what the ADA requires in terms of timing. The ADA requires an interactive process. And when I said my two points interact, that's the point that Your Honor raised about the, you know, did you work with him? There was no effort to work with Thompson.
How is the letter not evidence of an effort to find out what they needed to find out to know what kind of leave was being requested?
I'd say it's a piece of evidence, absolutely. I'm not saying it should be discounted, far from it. What I'm saying is an interactive process requires far more. An interactive process, according to the case law, requires that the employer go and seek out the employee and sit down and discuss with the employee what steps are necessary. And I'll leave it with Gail Krieg's testimony herself, because it goes to both Your Honor's points. I asked Ms. Krieg about the timing. I said, why not give him more time? Meaning, why not give him more time to submit medical records? Her answer, that's a good question. Question, do you have one? An answer? Answer, I really don't. I mean, I think that we could have given him more time. That's unlawful, Your Honor. The grant of summary judgment should be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. For both parties here, your briefing was very helpful, as was the arguments here today. We'll take the matter under advisement at this time, and we will issue a decision on the matter within 90 days. Thank you.